Feeling stuck by a tough life decision? Wondering how to navigate career and leadership changes without chaos? Welcome to Problem Solved, the podcast where we cut through the confusion and turn uncertainty into action. I'm your host, Cheryl Strauss Einhorn, and I'm here to empower you with a powerful tool, the AREA Method. Forget overwhelm, forget endless Googling, get ready to make confident, well-researched decisions that take charge of your life. Whether it's finding the perfect college, the ideal career path, or the best care for your loved ones. This isn't just about theory. Here we'll tackle real-world scenarios, dive into inspiring stories, and equip you with actionable steps. So buckle up, listeners, because it's time to say goodbye to indecision and hello to solutions. Hello, and welcome to the Problem Solve podcast, where we talk about the complex problems that you're solving. Today, we're going to talk about selling your family business, and we're going to be joined by David McCombie. He's the founder and CEO of McCombie Group, a mergers and acquisition advisory firm that improves, grows, and sells mid-market companies, and he has a brand new book out on selling your business with confidence. He's a veteran dealmaker who's personally negotiated billions in transaction value and has been recognized for setting record valuations. He is unique among advisors, passionate as an entrepreneur, and also has successfully led various private equity investments himself. He currently serves as a membership officer of the YPO Miami chapter. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School and the University of Miami. David, welcome to the Problem Solved podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Cheryl. It's exciting to be here.
Thank you. So we always start off asking, why should we invest in being better decision makers?
You know, it's a great question. The reality is that every situation and result that you're at is a function of decisions that you made along the way, right? And those decisions often are sequential. And poor decisions can often structurally position you for failure. And conversely, good decisions can put you in a much better position for success. And, you know, it's very easy often when there's no emotions in the picture to make good decisions, or at least it's easier. But that gets considerably more complex when you're under a cocktail of emotions that really impact how you view the situation and how you, interpret it and ultimately make, decisions.
Absolutely. Emotions can certainly get in the way of good thinking. Share a little bit about your background. Tell us how you got into what you're doing now and how you ended up opening your own mergers and acquisition firm.
So I ended up starting the firm 15 years ago, actually. I lost my job in the great, financial crisis. I was at McKinsey & Company, learned a lot there. And ultimately, needed to kind of very quickly figure out what I wanted to do. And at the time, it was frustrating. There weren't any jobs that I was really excited about that would really pay me what I thought I was worth. And so I ended up going down the entrepreneurial route. In hindsight, probably one of the best decisions for me in terms of the right fit for my personality and kind of my personal life objectives and all that, having taken the path, least traveled. I did do briefly prior to that point investment banking. And, I actually started initially advising different family offices on their private equity transactions, ended up doing a handful of different private equity transactions with, some of those family offices. And, ultimately decided to transition primarily to the advisory side about 5 or 6 years ago, primarily for personal and kind of lifestyle design decisions. Thankfully, a lot of those, investments did well. I really had to reflect and say, okay, what is it that I'm good at? What is it that excites me? What are the parameters that are important for me? For example, being on the road 50 weeks of the year, just is not a great fit for my personality, nor for my desire to be a present, you know, father for my young daughters. Ultimately, thankfully, it was a great transition. A lot of ways, it was really shifting from an investor to an entrepreneur. Particularly in the markets that I focus upon, there's a lot of opportunity and not necessarily a lot of competition. And so it was exciting to go and find those opportunities and then go figure out how to go and capitalize upon it. So it's been a journey, as pretty much any entrepreneurial life has been. But all in all, it's been a great experience.
Well, that's great. And tell us about your new book, Selling Your Business with Confidence. What made you write this?
Great question. So Selling Your Business with Confidence really was written for a strategic reason, which was what I found is my biggest competitor is not another firm in the middle market. It's actually business owners trying to sell themselves. And so the thought process was, if I can reveal to them what excellence looks like, then they will realize that they didn't even realize the first question, let alone the second or third, peel back of the onion. The reality is most business owners are woefully unprepared for the process and what happens afterwards, which it's, both a financial transaction, but it's also a personal transition that is going to occur in their life that very oftentimes they don't think about the implications of it. But if you ask a lot of business owners, implicitly, they think that it's similar to selling a house. And yes, there's commonalities that it's a sale of a large, valued asset. But the reality is it's completely different on a number of different levels. And so my thought process was, if I can write something that's engaging and explaining to them, what's going to happen, and they realize, wow, there are people out there, and most definitely the buyers that I'm going to confront are playing very intentionally this 3-day game of chess, and I don't really even know the first elements, I'm going to be outgunned. So that was really the rationale for it. I like to describe it as, before you have a baby, you typically go to birthing classes. It doesn't make the birth any easier, but at least it reduces the anxiety of what's happening through the process. You know it's going to be hard during this period. You know that these are going to be challenging moments, but you don't have to fight against the anxiety of, oh my God, my wife is going to die. It's something which was definitely a long, intense process. You have plenty of experience with writing and books and lots of, for me, it was a novel experience, but something I'm really proud of having accomplished.
Well, it's written in such a straightforward and honest way. It's a very easy, common sense read. Share with us, why do you think so many business owners do underestimate the complexity of selling their business?
I think it's because just taking a step back, a little bit of context. In the current environment where there's almost $1 trillion of private equity dry powder or capital that's waiting to get deployed out there, there has basically been a whole ecosystem of advisors and essentially cold callers that are calling on business owners. And their mission is actually to buy stuff below market. And in fact, if you look at the marketing literature that tries to solicit investors for a lot of these private equity funds, they tout their ability to get what's called proprietary or off-market deal flow because they can buy it cheaper. If not, they wouldn't be spending all the time and resources and money in order to do that. So the average business owner of a middle market business is receiving 1 to 2 calls per week. Many are actual buyers. Others are some type of broker. And then there's, plenty of catch-all of people just throwing spaghetti against the wall and hoping to, make some opportunity that they can, profit from. So the average business owner is inundated with a lot of these inbound messages and kind of feels like, well, the hard part is done. I already have the buyer. The reality is that, they are probably one of thousands of businesses that are being contacted. Those people on the other side don't really have any real insight into the true nature of their business because they haven't, you know, they're a private business. They really don't know what's there or not. And so they implicitly are conflating the fact of having a potentially interested buyer with, you know, what the hard stuff, right? But the reality is that even in, you know, a traditional process, only about 50% of letters of intent actually close. And when you talk about these unsolicited inquiries, the percentage is significantly less, right? So even if you didn't care about price and you just care about doing a deal, having a buyer, having a few buyers, yes, is a good thing to have, but is not setting yourself up for, you know, for success. And then, you know, ultimately, if they've never been through the process as a buyer or, you know, in some other context where they've been able to see it, they don't realize the extensiveness of the process, right? So there are an army essentially of third-party advisors whose job is to find the negative things and unearth it. And that is a tedious task to go through that, you know, that process.
So there's sort of an asymmetry in the understanding of what's actually happening, the level of interest, the level of knowledge about the specific business and or the industry. That's interesting. So how can a business owner evaluate the potential value of their business before beginning these sales processes so that they can have a better way to think about the information that they're hearing?
Yeah, look, I think in terms of getting a good sense of their business, the wrong way to do it is to basically take, you know, multiples that you hear at the country club or that you might read in the Wall Street Journal and just blindly apply it to your business. Because the reality is, you know, all valuation is essentially using an analogy to they're going to say this other thing was valued at X. We are better or worse. Therefore, we're X plus or we're X minus, right? And so when you think about it from that vantage point, particularly given that private transactions are private, there's very little data that's available. It is an extremely subjective and complex process to have, you know, a really you know, accurate viewpoint on what the value of a business is, even for somebody like myself, right? You know, we can triangulate, we can get, but the market is constantly moving in terms of its sentiment. The characteristics of your business relative to the other ones could be completely different, both quantitatively and qualitatively, right? So you're never going to get a perfect answer until you actually go and have conversations with the market. But in order to get a general sense of it, and in particular, I think what's most important, what are the drivers that would be most important for a business owner to focus upon? You know, I would recommend having conversations with, you know, different M&A advisors or investment bankers. Almost all of them will have it for free. And they can basically provide you with, you know, a more rigorous assessment of looking at your numbers and saying, look, this is the ballpark of what they believe it to be. But more importantly, can give you the rationale around, look, these are the factors that would make it more valuable or less valuable. And, you know, that's basically as well a free option that allows you to essentially assess their work product, assess their values, assess their quality for that moment in the future when there's the opportunity to sell that you say, okay, yeah, this person is the right fit.
And so generally,
similarly, a lot of them, just to complete that thread, will, you know, given that they know the basics of your business, will be able to serve informally as a sounding board over the years, and often can give you very valuable insights around, well, this is the way a buyer would view this issue or not. And you can make a decision, an informed decision accordingly.
So you mentioned that there are these factors that investment bankers or other third-party advisors could share that could actually improve a business's value and sellability. Share with us what are a few of those things that, you know, a family-owned business might be thinking about to to consider that would help to bolster their value and sellability if selling is what they're preparing to do?
Sure, sure. So the first, which I guess is the most foundational, is, you know, make sure that your financials are, you know, clean and up to date. You know, it always amazes me the number of businesses that, you know, after we get engaged, have some major corrections in their financials. You know, ultimately, you know, that's not something that you want to reveal to a prospective buyer. You want to have that cleaned up beforehand and showing everything buttoned up, right? So to the extent that that's not, you know, fully, you know, up to snuff, I think it's an easy thing that is a no regret move anyways, right? It would help you if you went to a bank for financing. It's going to give you more comfort with making sure that there's not, you know, some type of theft within your business. So all those things, I think, are you know, no regret moves. I think the other thing is important is to look at, essentially, are there deal breakers that are going to turn off significant buyers, or, you know, make your business unsellable. I like to talk about what are called existential risks. What it means is, you know, the magnitude is so large that even if it's a very low probability event, you know, buyers are often going to decide to just pass on it. Because you have to remember, investors have alternative options for their time and money. And so, you know, while it could be a great deal, even at a low price, the risk is often not worth it, particularly because, you know, an investor is not a monolithic entity. It's comprised of individual employees that have different incentives and all that. And, you know, nobody wants to, you know, tell their boss to approve a big, you know, multi-million dollar investment. And then, you know, you wake up a week later and, you know, half of the valley is evaporated, right? That's not a pathway to career success. So what are some different areas that I frequently see that are big value detractors? Three that I'll put out there real quickly. One is, you know, customer concentration, right? Having one big customer that basically drives a disproportionate amount of your business is very scary for an investor because particularly if it's a strong relationship with you as an individual, they're worried that that could go away and everything that they paid for, you know, is illusory. Secondly, and similarly, you know, often there's a lot of concern around businesses that have what's called key person risk. So in other words, the business is really dependent upon this one individual, whether it's their ability to sell or just understanding the secret sauce, and God forbid something were to happen to them, you know, significant value would be eroded. And this is one of those other areas where it's really a no-regret move in that if you can build up your management team, it provides you the benefit of being able to take a multi-week vacation. It provides you the benefit of being able to have a less stressful life. But it also provides that comfort level to the buyer that, you know, this is a business that's sustainable outside of you as an individual. Of course, they can try to structure things with, you know, in creative ways to align incentives, but God forbid, you know, you were to get hit by a bus or you just go to the Bahamas, what is going to happen, you know, in the future? And then, you know, the last, you know, often occurs associated with, you know, whether it's major lawsuits or investigations from the government, but, you know, those are things that ultimately add complexity and, you know, negative energy, quite frankly, that, you know, most buyers just are not super excited to, you know, to sign up for. And so, and while some of them are easier to address than others, if you can take the time with the luxury of time and say, okay, let me look at what are the things which are kind of the worst attributes of my business to a buyer and systematically address it, you'll do wonders in terms of increasing the marketability and ultimately the valuation of the business.
Great. So beyond some of these actual business and management issues, obviously selling a business is a deeply personal and emotional thing as well. So how do you recommend that owners prepare themselves for those psychological challenges?
That's a great question. You know, I think that it's important for them to recognize that they're both economically and emotionally invested in their business. You know, this is often 80%+ of their net worth, but as well, you know, many people refer to it as their baby, right? And so they view it as such. You know, many business owners neglect a lot of their important, you know, family and kind of personal relationships at the expense of you know, dedicating it to work, and really have their identity wrapped up in the business, you know. And so, you know, I think it's really important that they do two things that can help kind of minimize, because you're going to be under the influence of emotions during the process, right? You're going to be defensive, given all the due diligence questions that are critiquing your baby. There's a lot of different factors that create this cocktail of emotions. The first is, I highly encourage clients to journal up front and say, look, this is the rationale for why I'm doing this transaction. Because it's very easy afterwards, when you're in the heat of the battle, to have kind of a revisionist perspective and to take a stand on something. But when you looked back upon it, you weren't even expecting that up front, right? And you would have been happy. And so, you know, really documenting, this is what I'm doing, this is why I'm doing it, because the process will be difficult. There will be friction and challenges and all of that. And so being able to have a reminder of, you know, of that, I think is helpful to be able to refer to during the transaction and sometimes even afterwards, right? You know, where you may have regrets. Well, but there were a lot of reasons that are really valid and valuable reasons of why I chose to do it in the first place, right? And then secondly, I think is, you know, it's absolutely essential to surround yourself with support. Whether it's a, you know, a spouse or a friend or a peer group or whatever it is, you know, it is important that you have somebody that you can speak your, you know, your fears and your concerns and all of that too. And that can be a sounding board, not necessarily around the technical elements. You will have an expert of team members to do that, but that really can say, look, I know you. I know a little bit from the outside situation and can help walk you off the ledge, you know, if that, you know, were to occur. And I can definitely speak from personal experience. You know, I have gone through the process of buying and ultimately selling different businesses. And actually, when I've sold and exited the business interest I've been involved in, I've always hired a third party. And most people say, well, why do you do this for a living? But the reality is that I'm too emotionally close to, you know, to the situation. And there's a variety of different things structurally from a negotiation standpoint that I, as a decision maker, could never be as effective as an agent in doing. And, you know, one of those things is, you know, there's a lot of emotional tells, using a poker term, that an astute buyer who does this for, you know, daily living is picking up on and basically using that information, you know, against you in terms of trying to get the best deal for themselves. You know, leaning on your support network and documenting it beforehand that you can refer back to, I think are two really important things, because we actually observe in about half of the transactions that we engage in that some type of self-sabotage type behavior will emerge. And often it's around a realization, particularly when we talked about the personal transition, that, yeah, I've thought about it from what I'm running away from, and I've thought about it from the financial standpoint and all of that, but I hadn't really given a lot of thought to, wow, my life is going to be dramatically different at the end of this. And for a lot of people, it's scary. And so it's human nature, and there's a cognitive bias, which I'm blanking on the name, you know, right now. But essentially, it's around, many humans would prefer uncertainty, or would prefer unhappiness over uncertainty. So they'd rather resolve it, even if it's in a suboptimal way, rather than being patient and letting the things unfold. So we see that.
Sounds like you have a lot of empathy for what somebody is going through and the idea of the journaling and holding yourself accountable, but it also makes it easier in your relationship with that seller as well to be able to have an account of why the person is doing this, a gentle reminder for themselves and so on, and then definitely the support network for all of the difficult parts of the process. That's great. Do you want to share an example, David, of a challenging negotiation and how it was resolved just briefly?
Sure. Happy to do so. One of the most challenging negotiations or situations that we have is negotiating when the actual business owner wants to be intimately involved and actually participate in the negotiations. And the reason why that's challenging is, ultimately, as a decision maker, you can be placed on the spot and expected to provide an answer right then and there, as opposed to an agent can basically negotiate on your behalf, but really doesn't have the authority to make the final decision. It's the reason why when you buy a car, you almost never negotiate directly with the manager. The guy has to go and check with his manager, but the manager never comes out. And there's a reason for that, right? And so they talk about negotiating with limited authority. And so one of the biggest challenges that I have is when a client wants to communicate and essentially discuss substantive matters in parallel or at the same time with a potential buyer, because it becomes very difficult to then say, okay, let's analyze that decision that was made, let's analyze the implication, and then if we don't like it, let's try to roll it back. It's much harder to put the toothpaste back in the tube than it is to say, okay, here's the situation, let's look at it calmly and get all the facts, versus often it can be framed in a way that you may commit to something that is seems relatively innocuous, but could have some major implications, afterwards. And even ourselves, often things may turn on little details that without going and researching it, right, and basically playing it all out and seeing what the bottom line implication is, it's difficult to know, is this a positive or a negative benefit?
It must be so difficult to really be dispassionate and to sit in that room and to not say something when they're the person who's been running that business for such a long time, and to recognize that actually that holding back in those moments provides greater flexibility to them. So thank you for sharing that. Do you want to talk for a minute about just a few key factors to consider when interpreting and comparing offers from buyers?
Sure. So look, every buyer essentially is selling you on their offer, and they're going to spin it in the best light possible, not necessarily in the most objective light, right? And so what you often find is many buyers will reframe their offers to seem very big. Most of the time what they're doing is they're putting out what is the highest potential, outcome, and hiding really the fine print, or at least not emphasizing the fine print that goes into it. And so there's actually an adage in M&A, which is you set the price and I set the terms, right? The reality is that the terms are extremely important and meaningful. Unlike in the sale of a house or in most assets where you buy it in dollars and it is easily comparable, right? This was $50 and this is $60 and this one is $10 higher. Most transactions, the overwhelming majority of transactions in the middle market involve only a partial payment in cash. most will involve various other forms of payment that collectively represent the offer. So one will be cash that you receive upfront, but typically you'll have other things such as contingent payments, often referred to as an earnout, meaning, hey, if you hit certain numbers, you'll get paid certain payouts. The buyer will request some type of loan that you would provide back and you would get an interest rate on. There's even equity that you would participate alongside the buyer in the going forward business. And so all of those things that are not clear cut, you know, US dollar forms of consideration have room for interpretation, or at least room for manipulation in terms of how it's communicated. So it's really important when you're analyzing offers that that you really try to boil everything down into an apples and apples comparison between the offers, right? So if one is expecting you to achieve a 10% return to receive it, and another is, you know, expecting you to have a much higher, you know, growth rate, you need to say, okay, well, let me choose a consistent yardstick to judge both against. And the reality is you probably want to do it at a couple different points. Well, what happens if I perform, you know, at the current level? What happens if I do 10% better, 20% better, whatever it is, right? So almost building like a sensitivity table to see what are the actual bottom line outcomes that you would receive under the different, you know, scenarios. And then what I recommend to clients is essentially trying to convert those forms of consideration on an expected value and on a time value, time weighted basis into a current cash equivalent value, right? So say, well, here's an earnout, but it's going to be paid over the next 3 years. It is, relatively achievable, but there's some stretch goals. Well, given both the time value of money and given the reality of the underlying metrics that I need to hit, I'm going to discount that by 40%. There's some rigorous ways to do it, but at the end of the day, it's going to be an inexact science. It's more important that at least you're thinking through the risks inherent in it, and trying your best to calibrate between the offers. And so what you would find is that often an offer that somebody says, at least at the top line, what they're, waving the flag about, it could be the highest one, may not be the most compelling. And so it really is about delving into the details and seeing the intricacies of it. So whether it's, if you loan the money, well, what's the interest rate? You know, if it's a market interest rate, it could be relatively equivalent to the cash value. But conversely, if it's a significantly below market interest rate, functionally what you're doing is you're giving a discount to them. They could have gotten that money from the bank, but the bank would have charged them a much higher interest rate, right? And that's functionally a discount that you're, providing as part of the
purchase. Very good advice, right? The headline number is actually not always what it seems to be, that you need to look behind it and that you need to take into account the contextual factors that are going to impact it and sort of also match that against what your needs are in terms of the money. Tell us briefly, I think that was a really important pitfall to avoid when closing a deal. Is there anything else on that that you'd want to mention? And to also offer a piece of advice to a mid-market business owner considering a sale now, what would that be?
So, this is a little bit self-serving, but there's facts and evidence behind it. I personally think you can hire me, hire anybody else, but you would be doing yourself a disservice not to surround yourself with an A-team level of professionals to represent you in selling. The reality is private equity firms, and there's various studies that show this, over 99% of the time use an advisor to sell their business. And they're not doing it because, it's charitable. They do it because on a net basis, they end up with more dollars on the bottom line. And there's various studies that show that essentially is going to result in around 25% more in terms of their dollars. But more importantly, and a lot of times people don't think about, a higher likelihood of closing. Nobody wants to go through this super time intensive and emotionally draining process multiple times, and a less stressful process, right? So that's an area that I would highly encourage, you know, interview lots of people, get the right fit. But, you know, trying to do it yourself is ultimately going to be a disservice to yourself in the long run. Yes, you may save a little bit of money, but on a net basis, you're going to do, you know, worse off. In terms of some common areas that I've seen mistakes, you know, in particular, I find that the type A personality that makes a entrepreneur successful in building a business often can be detrimental to them in the sale process.
Yeah.
And so one thing that I want to, you know, to just kind of illuminate a little bit is the bias for action that is really helpful in building, you know, and that sense of urgency and accelerating everything is great when you're building a business. But in a negotiation, it is not what is going to set you up for the best negotiating position, right? That sense of urgency and wanting to push the deal as fast as possible, get resolution as fast as possible, is ultimately going to be interpreted as a sense of a source of weakness, and, you know, a level of urgency and sometimes desperation that will be used, you know, against you. Similarly, I see a lot of business owners that want to procrastinate and go to market as quickly as possible without having done all of their homework. The reality is that, you know, when you do go into the process, you are going to be entering an incredibly time-intensive period where you're already running your business and you have another second job of the transaction. So any type of procrastination essentially is shifting these critical tasks that need to occur from a period when you have the luxury of time and introspection and all that to a period which is jam-packed, emotional. And what happens is that often in the rush, you have mistakes and other things which come back to, you know, to hurt you, right? One of the things that, you know, a lot of people don't realize is that one of the unsexy things that makes deals close is making it easy for the buyer to say yes. So putting things on a silver platter is important. So every time you provide them information that doesn't reconcile, or there's an inconsistency or whatever, yes, you can get to the bottom of it, but you're basically putting sand in the gears. And remember that the investor, the buyer, has alternative things to do with their time.
Right.
And so, you know, the more that you can do in terms of preparing beforehand, doing dry runs, double checking, all of that, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So, you know, these are things that I've observed, you know, frequently just because of the inherent nature of you know, a lot of the personalities that have built these businesses. And, you know, like I said, these are not bad attributes objectively, but in the context of a transaction can often come back to, you know, to bite them.
These are great common sense recommendations. What haven't we asked you, David?
Well, you know, I mean, I think we've covered, you know, pretty much everything. The only other thing that often comes up is just, you know, what does the market look like, and how's it been changing and all that. And, you know, ultimately, we, at least as we're sitting today in early 2025, are seeing a much greater level of activity that we saw in 2024. I think that the, you know, relatively nominal, but the decrease in interest rates over the past 6 to 8 months has definitely been a tailwind. But there are a variety of other, you know, factors that seem like 2025 will be a much more robust year of activity. And, you know, I think from a business owner standpoint, whether you intend to sell today or just someday, there's never too late of a time to start. The sooner you start, the better of a outcome you're going to, achieve. And, the reality is that a more marketable and more valuable business, often, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, is, consistent with a lot of other things that you'd want, even if you choose not to sell. So, right. Less stressful life.
Business practices.
Correct. Better lifestyle, more financeable by a bank, whatever it is. And so I know it's easy for the urgent to push out the important, but I'd highly encourage people to, give the space to think about what are the things that they should be working on and intentionally finding the time to actually work on it over the coming months, years, decades, whatever that time frame might be.
David, thank you so much. The book is Selling Your Business with Confidence. It's been an interesting conversation filled with sage advice. David, thank you so much. And to all of our Problem Solve podcast listeners, thank you for joining us today. And we look forward to joining you again in our next episode. Thank you.
Thank you, Cheryl.